Good afternoon. I'm Jim Packard in for Larry Mueller, and we continue with Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and specifically landscaping with native plants, this trees and shrubs, grasses, forbs, and vines, with Molly Fifield-Murray, who directs outreach and educational programs for the UW-Madison Arboretum. Molly, again, thank you so much for coming in today.
It's a pleasure.
And this is the anniversary of the Arboretum, and in there I mentioned the various communities that you have there. It just has to be amazing to see everything at one time.
Well, it is, and it's, of course, useful for students who can't travel all over the state to see all of these. But some of them are more successful than others. The 33 different plant communities that they thought they might be able to plant there, some of them are not as successful as the prairies have been, or the oak woods, which were, and savannas, which were naturally here. So mm-hmm. The boreal forest is a little bit out of its range, and we frequently don't get enough snow in southern Wisconsin to support or protect, actually, the ground layer species of the boreal forest. So we might be able to grow the spruces, but not the partridge pea or the bunchberry or the some of the things that would be growing under them. So when you get too far out of range, it's not always successful.
If you'd like to join the conversation, the lines are open for you at 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. And Gabrielle asks, is angelica a native plant? There's some in a park nearby, and when they mow the shoulder, they mow it down.
Yes, it is a native plant, and it's quite spectacular right now. Angelica is, well, there's two plants that are quite showy right now that I have trouble telling apart without thinking about it. Mm-hmm. One is angelica, and the other one is cow parsnip. They're very large. They get quite tall. Angelica has a red stem, and as one of our naturalists, Kathy Miner, says, it looks like the dome of heaven. So that's how she remembers that between. It's a round umbel on angelica, whereas cow parsnip looks a little more like a cow pie. It's a flat umbel. They are native. They're in the parsley family, and they're interesting plants. I'm not sure I'd put it in the front yard, but it's a very interesting plant.
And she also asked the question that has some application for everybody else. I was thinking of collecting some seed, and this is from a nearby park, and planting it in my yard.
Of the angelica?
Yes.
Well, okay. So it gets very tall. It can get 8 feet tall. It is taproot, so it doesn't spread everywhere, but I'd worry about it in an area that might cause objections from others. We still have the problem in native plantings that even though it's much better than it used to be 30 or 40 years ago, more accepted, I mean, there still are cities who object to native plants in front yard gardens, particularly native grasses. It's very unfortunate. And sometimes people feel threatened when they see a tall batch of grasses and flowers. And so there are weed laws that can force people to cut things down. So an 8 foot tall angelica in front might be a little bit threatening to some people. And also, if you're collecting seed, you need to remember to get permission. Even though angelica is not a threatened species, collecting seeds is, of course, better than digging up plants. And this is one that would not dig readily because it does have a taproot. And collecting seeds, it's still nice to get permission and only collect about the third of the seeds in an area so that there's enough there for wildlife and natural spread of the plant.
Let's go to the phones to Vicki in Eau Claire. Hello, Vicki.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. We moved into our house back in 1993, and the builder wanted us not to remove, it looked like probably an 8 foot shrub because it had multiple trunks to it at the time. It's now 30 feet. We still don't know what it is. What happens is in the spring, it'll get a flower, white flower, a very light multi-petal flower, and you'll see the same flowering in ditches if you're traveling around. And then after the flowers are down about 3 days, it'll start to grow the leaves, and they're about 1-inch oval leaves. And then right now it has multiple little beginnings of, my husband calls them little apples. I think they're little red berries that come, but they only are about a quarter of an inch at their maturity. Do you have any idea what this might be?
It sounds to me like it's an amelanchier, to use the Latin. It has a lot of common names. Juneberry is one of them, serviceberry, shadbush. It's actually one of the woody plants that I recommend most for if you can only have one or two in your area, because it's beloved by birds. The cedar waxwings have already been at the juneberries at my house, and they're green still, so I think that's not quite fair. I think I have taken photos of every songbird in the area in a juneberry getting the berries. So if that's what it is, you're very fortunate.
Well, that's what I'm wondering if it could be. Sometimes after they start eating on the tree, though, they start to get a little crazy, and then they start running into my windows.
Okay.
We get so many birds, and I don't know if that, does that happen to you?
Well, we actually hang Mylar streamers down in front of our windows so that the birds can tell that the windows are there.
Oh.
But we have had mishaps with birds. Sometimes they will run into the window if they're eating something that has fermented a little bit. But they also, I mean, they really love it. This was one, this plant, if it is serviceberry, was also a very important food for Native Americans. And it tastes a little bit like a not very flavorful blueberry. But it's one of the first things that it's ripe. So you can imagine how when this fruit was ready, it was eagerly eaten both by Native Americans and wildlife.
So they can get up to like 30 feet. It's a great, it's beautiful. But it's big.
Yes. Well, there are many species of amelanchier, and they are in the rose family, and they interbreed. So when you're seeing them in the wild, it might have characteristics of the tree form of amelanchier, Amelanchier arborea, or it might have characteristics of Amelanchier laevis, which is doesn't get quite as tall. I have one at my place that's 40 feet tall and very tree-like, and I have others that are just as old, and they're maybe 15 feet tall. So,
Okay. Thank you.
All right, Vicki, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate hearing from you. And if you'd like to join in, the lines are open at 1-800-642-1234 as we talk about landscaping with native plants with Molly Fifield-Murray. And you can get more information at uwarboretum.org. And find out what's going on there. Get a collection of native plants that are planted there for the southern part of the state. And you can also find out about the activities coming up on the 21st when the Arboretum celebrates its 75th birthday. Is the Arboretum size generally the same as it was back 75 years ago, or have there been farms and surrounding land added to the to the Arboretum property?
75 years ago, it was about 500 acres, but they were continuing to acquire land during the Depression when land prices were depressed and they were able to purchase land. The last piece of land that they wanted to acquire that was substantial was called the Williams Farm at the time, and that is actually it became a neighborhood called Arbor Hills in Madison. And that was in 51. I know that John Curtis was hoping to be able to acquire that land, but they did not. The last pieces of land they did acquire were small lots that they had to buy up one by one in an area that we now call the Lost City, that they had been sold for housing, and then the contracting company failed in the Depression, well, just before, actually. And then lots of the land was very wet and not good for building. I'd also like to mention, if people are nearby, that Wednesday night, the 17th, there is a walk in the native plant gardens to introduce people to how they can use native plants in their gardens. And we have a couple of walks coming up in the native gardens on Wednesdays at 7 p.m., both the 17th and the 24th. So that's a nice way to see how you might design a native garden for your home landscape, is to come for that walk.
And you'd also see the work of the special artist who's coming, who has an exhibition there right now through the 30th of June, Vanishing Landscapes and Endangered Species by Joseph Inglesby. He will also be giving a talk during the birthday party from 2 to 3 o'clock about his environmental art. So that's exciting.
Yes.
All right. Let's take an email. We have 3.5 acres near Rosholt, Wisconsin, and a large field-type area that I would like to plant with native plants, native prairie plants. It always seems that it's never a good time to burn it in the spring because of fire danger. There's a woods right across a dirt road with lots of dead trees. There's currently just grass and weeds with a little poison ivy near the road. Do we have to do something in the spring, or can we do something in the summer or fall?
Well, that's a very interesting question. First of all, because of the poison ivy, I'd be very careful about burning and not get in the smoke that where it's burning through poison ivy, because then you get horrible rashes, not only on the outside, but in your lungs. So be very careful. It's best to have training or some experienced fire management group to come in and do a burn, particularly if you haven't done it before or haven't seen it done. There are people who hire out for that. I know even some volunteer fire departments have people who sort of moonlight as the professional fire starters for restoration activities. Burning it off is one way to get started, and then seeding in afterwards. That was an experiment that they did at the Arboretum in the 1940s, was to see how things responded. If it's bluegrass and you burn it off, it diminishes greatly, and then you can seed it. And you can burn. Natural fires probably were frequently in the summer if they were lightning started, but fall fires can be very effective. But it's finding the day to burn, particularly if you're managing smoke from the poison ivy and not going across a road or something, finding the exact day to burn can be difficult.
Okay. Let's go to Deb in Wales next. Hi, Deb. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm a member of a church in the Waukesha County area, and we're putting in a commemorative garden. The hardscaping is done, and we all agree we want to work with native plants. We have a lot of familiarity with them, but we need some advice on design. And I was wondering if you had any recommendations on who we could work with to do the design.
I would contact Retzer Nature Center that is near you.
Okay.
And talk to them about who's available in the area and has done work. I know they have seed sales themselves, but I doubt that they actually do contract work on design, but they can give you advice of people in the area.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you very much. And we've put out some email addresses, we've talked about some books, and we've heard from the city of Prairie du Chien. And so let's go back over that. The book that was referred to is Lynn Steiner, S-T-E-I-N-E-R, Landscaping with Native Plants of Wisconsin. You also have the book Prairie Plants of the University of Wisconsin-Madison Arboretum. That's available through their bookstore as well. In the Milwaukee area, native plants can be found at Monch's Farm. That's monchesfarm.com or 262-966-2787. And in the Green Bay area, Stone Silo Prairie Gardens at stonesiloprairie.com or 920-366-1662. So thanks to Bonnie for providing that information. We've also got the Green Bay chapter of Wild Ones, Native Plants and Natural Landscapes with the Flip My Lawn contest. And a homeowner in that Green Bay area will win a garden makeover, including $750 of native plants and landscaping. Applications are on the website, which is 4-wild.org. And From there, they can navigate to the chapters in Wisconsin and to Green Bay, and you'll find wild ones at the Green Bay Farmers Market tomorrow morning with more information. Is the Arboretum generally represented at the Farmers Market or not?
Not. We don't have the staffing to do that, and our building is open that day, so people could go to the Farmers Market in the morning, have their scones and coffee and pick up some plants. There are native gardens, nurseries that come there. Last time I was there, Blue Stem Farm was there. Mm-hmm. They're from the Baraboo area. They grow more unusual plants than many of the nurseries. They're quite expert at getting some of the lady slippers to grow, for instance, which are rare plants that really cannot be dug in the wild, not that any should, but they grow them, and it's a really good place to get them. I have also seen plants at various farmers markets that were obviously dug in the wild, and I would not buy that plant even if I thought it was going to live, because you really don't want to encourage that people to do that. Buy your native plants. There are so many nurseries now. There are three or four in the Westfield area, not just Prairie Nursery, but Oak Savannah Farm, Passflower Farm, and there are many in the Milwaukee area. There are just enough people who are growing these plants now that you don't need to get them dug in the wild.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that was curious to me is I've seen the names of native plants to the Midwest: prairie smoke, blue-eyed grass, bloodroot, staghorn, sumac. I generally don't have a picture that I can visualize with them. What accounts for this lack of understanding? Is this just me, or is it like the industry?
Well, some native plants have been readily available. Some of them are hard to grow. Of course, staghorn sumac is not hard to grow, mm-hmm. and some people don't. There was an aesthetic, particularly after World War II, there was this aesthetic that lawns should be clipped and no plants should grow. I mean, you could, if I think about the house I grew up in, there were Pfizer junipers and yews along the front in a row with some arborvitae on the corners, and you were supposed to trim those every year, and they could have been styrofoam for all they were allowed to grow. And so I think the concept of this highly maintained lawn was somehow incorporated into the American psyche as being the right thing, even though, for instance, in Victorian times, people thought houses should breathe. They would never have done foundation plantings like that. So, and there was this huge movement in the 20s to plant wildflowers. So mm-hmm. it's just, we hope this isn't just a movement now, that it's become more acceptable. If you drive around Madison, for instance, which I know is an island, but if you drive around Madison, you see native plantings in front yards all over the city, and it's much more highly accepted. But some plants are very hard to grow. So yellow star grass and blue-eyed grass, they're blooming now. Their seeds are available in July, but they're very hard to find because by that time the prairie is a foot or two taller. And so sometimes things were not available in the trade because they were just took too much time to grow. But then you have places like Little Blue Stem Farm and others who are starting to grow these because they grow them in a way that allows them to get the seed. Prairie Smoke is quite beautiful. I don't know why that wouldn't have been available more in the trade. So it's just when you can't find the shrubs and trees in the trade, sometimes it's because they are hard to grow.
Mm-hmm. And another thing that occurred to me is that trying to manage 1,200 acres it takes a lot of volunteers.
Yes.
How important are they to your success?
They're absolutely essential. You know, when we think about the Arboretum being started in the Depression, and we had the Civilian Conservation Corps there, we had 200 men that helped plant that. We lost a fair number of those plantings to the droughts of 34, 35, and 36, and then we lost even more when the Department of Transportation decided to put the Beltline Highway through. 15,000 trees were lost, and we're even threatened today or yesterday by the American Transmission Company being allowed to come right down the Beltline, which it goes right through the Arboretum. So,
did they get approval on that?
They did get approval yesterday, much mm-hmm. to our disappointment. Mm-hmm. So we have over 700 volunteers that help us. That's the equivalent of more than five full-time staff. And the Arboretum is part of the university. It is a research facility. We have three full-time staff to take care of the 1,200 acres. And then we have two other staff that are highly involved in taking care. So you might say five. We have one gardener for the Longenecker Garden, which is 35 acres of gardens, compared to other gardens that might have, you know, at least six for that area. So the volunteers are absolutely essential. We also think it's important, as I mentioned at the very beginning, Leopold's idea was not only that we would restore the land, but we would restore this relationship between people and the land, whereas people would get to understand the ecosystem that supports life.
Mm-hmm.
And by volunteering at places like the Arboretum, you get to learn about ecological principles and native plants and how native gardens, it would be nice to get rid of, say, 7/10 of lawn grass and have those be native plants that are helping water penetrate and not needing to be watered. 30% of the water used east of the Mississippi, where it rains a lot, is used to keep lawns alive. And lawns are use the most chemicals of any crop in the United States. So on the other hand, if you're playing Frisbee with your dog, you need a lawn.
Yeah.
So I'm not anti-lawn completely, but some modifications.
Molly, thank you so much for being here today. We look forward to your next visit and also to the Arboretum 75th birthday party, which will be Sunday, June 21st. That's at 1207 Seminole Highway in Madison. And we'll be talking with the artist who has an exhibition there at the Arboretum, Joseph Inglesby, next Wednesday at 11 o'clock. Thanks very much for listening today. Dave Potratz was our on-air producer. I'm Jim Packard, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. A reminder that on Monday, we'll be talking with Chancellor Biddy Martin about the challenges faced by officials in higher education, and Jim Lulazern will be talking about the optics industry and advice on prescription eyewear here on the Ideas Network.